Hello, everyone, and welcome to Resettled, A Human Journey, ECDC ACCDC's premier podcast. My name is Marcus Grant, and for this episode, we welcome Eva Stitt, the Refugee Behavioral Health Coordinator. Thank you for joining us today, Eva.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. It's an honor to be invited and to join you in this podcast.
All right. Can you just start by telling us about the work that you do for Virginia Department of Behavioral Health and Department of Services?
My work focuses on refugee mental health. I manage the program called the Virginia Refugee Healing Partnership, shortened as VRHP. This is a collaborative effort of the Virginia Department of Behavioral Health Developmental Services Office of Behavioral Health Wellness and the Office of Newcomer Services from the Virginia Department of Social Services. Our mission is to provide holistic care to refugees who see Virginia as a place of hope and refuge. Our vision looks into a future where refugees thrive and their needs are addressed and met through culturally and linguistically appropriate services. For 7 years now, I've been coordinating and supporting and educating stakeholders about the unique needs of refugees in terms of cultural viewpoints, healing practices, risk for trauma, and need for language access services, as well as understanding in how to navigate our U.S. healthcare system. And in Virginia, it's a little more difficult because our health department is separate from the behavioral health department. In other states, it's one and the same. So refugees in Virginia, for them to access mental health care, they really need to go to my agency called the Virginia Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services.
All right, thank you for that. When refugees first arrive in the U.S., what are some of the main mental health challenges that they face and how can it affect them on a long-term basis?
Okay. Refugees that resettled in Virginia come from all over the world. Their issues are varied, mostly related to reasons why they left their homeland. Refugees are defined by the United Nations as someone who is unable or have fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership to a particular group, organization, or their political opinion. The incidence of mental health issues with this refugee experience are tied to the issues that they experience from their country of origin and the country to which, you know, their second country to which they come to seek refuge before coming to the United States. So more common refugee mental health diagnoses are associated with post-traumatic stress disorder, major depression, generalized anxiety. Some do suffer panic attacks. Adjustment disorder are very common among children, and there are also somatization disorder. Others are culture-bound syndromes, which means that these are mental health issues that are only specific to certain populations. In our program, we encourage direct service workers helping the refugee population to understand refugee culture, and when appropriate, share this with mental health clinicians so that there would be less cultural disconnect as they kind of assess and evaluate the condition of our refugee population. So how does this affect on a long-term basis? We know that mental health disorders affect every aspect of life. Let's say depression. Depression and anxiety have very strong impact in the lives of people, including refugees. Let's say on the body itself. Okay, so I'm a nurse. I might be looking at this from the health point of view, but Example, anxiety can weaken the immune system. The person can easily get sick and have longer time to recover because they have these anxieties. Sick person cannot work, reducing the ability to maintain income, impacting not only himself, but also his family, right? Common issues that we see on the first 6 months to a year of refugee arrival is their inability to pay rent. And if you put it on top of mental health disorder impacting ability to work, then they are in double trouble because the need to pay rent is an important component to be in a safe environment. Let's say significant loss or increase in appetite. Significant loss means that they become more weak, and so they cannot work properly. If they get eating too much, they get diabetes, and so come along with other health issues, such as the first that come would be hypertension. Usually diabetes and hypertension are closely related. So being sick is not good. The third one, on mental health issues, are usually they indulge in alcohol and use of drugs, and it's not the consumption of alcohol or use of drug. It's the money that is used to spend on this that takes away the funds that should be probably for the maintenance of basic needs. So skin conditions like psoriasis can expose children to be bullied in school. So this is just one. We're just talking about anxiety. If we look into more specific illnesses, the complication to the impact on the life of refugee gets more and more. So refugees with mental health issues may deny or reject treatment. For example, they don't have insurance. They chose not to pay insurance because they don't have enough money to pay insurance. And our insurance here in the United States is really very expensive. Transportation is also hard. Many go to work on a carpool. So having to go to, let's say, a mental health treatment, transportation is a big issue. They cannot pay to be on Uber all the time. They may not have enough funds. Another is language access or interpreting. That's also a big issue because even if we have laws, federal laws, state laws, guidelines, we're not short of saying what can be done to include language access, but we know that this is not closely followed both in public and private mental health facilities. So in long-term effect, the issue of mental health is not confined to the individual alone, but rather to the individual, the family, and the community. And an individual who is not productive is not a contributing member of the community. So the impact is large, it's long lasting until someone gets treatment to resolve the issue.
Thank you for that. For the next question, for people working in resettlement, what are some ways that they can help and support mental health wellness within this population?
Thank you for including mental wellness and prevention. The office that I am attached with at the Virginia Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services is called the Office of Behavioral Health Wellness. So our focus is really on prevention. There is so much expense on the treatment side, and we don't want to do that. For our refugees, we just cannot afford it. So People working in resettlement can help support mental wellness with refugee population by, first, they need to have the knowledge. We cannot intentionally do what we plan to do if we don't know. So knowledge is important for resettlement workers, especially direct service professionals who are directly in touch with our refugee group. The second would be providing information that are within the level of understanding of our refugee population. Some have good education as in PhD or MD, some have masters, but others are not even literate in their own language. They speak the language, but they cannot read or write. So if you put English on top of that, it's doubly hard. So in our programming, we include learning English as a second language from kids to adults, because communication is an important aspect by which they can learn not only from the resettlement workers, but also from other members of the community. And it's really very hard to do what you'd like to do if you are not able to communicate. So first, resettlement workers need to have the knowledge. Two, they need to encourage refugees to learn English, because communication is essential to everyday life. And for our community here in the United States, we use English, and if they don't learn English, it's really very hard.
Okay. Just kind of following up on that, what are some signs that case managers can recognize if someone's struggling from mental health or wellness issues?
We are not in a position to make diagnosis. It's also not good to assume. So the best way is for us to have some tools. Mental health issues are not easy to recognize, especially at an early age. A lot of people seem like doing it in a normal way, but we know that it's only when they speak, it's only when they behave, it's only through the subtle gestures that we can see the big differences, and only trained clinicians can do that. In Virginia, we use the Refugee Health Screener 15, or RHS 15 for short, to screen refugees for emotional distress and mental health. This tool was developed and validated through a refugee population, and this is popularly used in the refugee resettlement areas. I think it's widely used in the different states across the United States. But this RHS 15 has 14 questions, and it's easy to, it can be self-administered, or if the person is not literate, an interpreter can be asked to interpret the written questions into a verbal question so that a refugee can answer. But when I work as a education specialist and working with mental health needs of refugees back many years ago, I used the questions in RHS 15 as a starting conversation. The questions are not technical. It's not even clinical. It's simple things like, have you been sleeping well? How do you feel today? You know, those are, if I start the conversation that way, I already have two purposes. One, I could initiate communication. Two, I'm already starting to see if there are issues that I need to be aware of. But if I do feel through the different questions that I ask, I do feel that they have a need based on their response, I will encourage them to formally take the RHS 15. And out of that, I have basis to say that through this assessment, the refugee may suffer from emotional distress or mental health issues, and they may need extra support through referrals to proper clinicians or proper authorities.
All right, thank you. Seems very useful. How has COVID-19 impacted refugees' mental health and wellness, and what are some of the best ways for agencies to offer support in these times right now?
Well, COVID impacted everyone, everybody, right? You and me are also impacted with it. But with refugee population, the greatest and immediate risk is infection. We all know how infectious COVID-19 is and how fatal it can be. Over 100,000 people have died, even if they have already received treatment. So even by the best effort of our nurses and doctors, some really cannot be helped. So what makes it worse is that no medicine yet is being approved by FDA, and our experts are still learning how to combat and reduce the impact on the second wave of crisis. So infection is the greatest risk for our refugee population. The other part is the stay-at-home order and social isolation. Some of our refugees are not used to being isolated or stay at home. In some communities, they socialize a lot. And when I may socialize, they don't use cell phones. They meet each other. They congregate. They sit under the tree and talk about anything and everything under the sun. With COVID-19, they are restricted to do this. And so home confinement might replicate the situation, the same situation that made them refugees. It could be the same thing that happened when they were fighting, when there was war in their country, or there was political persecution in their country, that they have to stay at home. So we learned that some of the refugees did have issues at the early part because they are not used to being confined, and they are not used to have limited social life. And on top of that, you add limited English proficiency, they might just suffer in silence. Other refugees may resort to the use of alcohol or drugs. And as I mentioned earlier, extra expense in this case means they solve one problem and create another problem. And it's not really very good. Loss of employment and income. We know in a family, income is an important baseline by which we survive and procure basic needs. With loss of income, we've heard reports, I have not seen the official report, but we've heard reports that after 2 months, some refugee resettlement agencies are still helping refugees to process their benefits. 2 months of not having any income, that is devastating. So what I shared is just a glimpse of how COVID-19 impacts the life of refugees. Now, how can agencies provide support? I'll go back to my example, health is wealth. Every prevention is worth a pound of cure. So it's disseminate information in ways refugees understand the importance of preventive measures such as hand washing, wearing of masks, maintain social distancing, and all those that were recommended by the CDC and our health department, the Virginia Department of Health. Also, we provide information of avoiding alcohol consumption or drug use because it exacerbates the situation. It's not really very helpful. And also provide opportunities to pass away time productively. For example, one resettlement agency gathered those who know how to sue, connect with them with a support organization, and together they were able to sell masks that refugees made, and refugees made money, and that was fantastic. Others found a way to connect refugees, and so they put a project together that they can work, you know, over the phone, because they have the same interest. So probably it has, they don't need too much work to describe what they'd like to do, but together they were able to produce something and a quality time as well. The Office of Newcomer Services, the state agency in charge of refugee resettlement in Virginia, has also developed novel and creative ways to support refugee resettlement. So in turn, they can support the refugees. They have programs for children to adult to older adults, and this has been disseminated to the different resettlement agencies across the state. Many refugee resettlement held fund drives, and it was very successful with the support of the community. We put a lot of them kind of the immediate need at the time when kids were off from school. They don't have computers, and kids need computers to do virtual learning. And with the computer, we need internet. So they provided some that are in need of computer and paid part of the internet so that kids will continue to learn and complete the school year. So there are a lot of collaboration going on, and in specific, as regards to how agencies can provide, it really depends on the need of the target population, the resources of the resettlement agency, and what is available at the time it's needed.
Okay. Yeah, they're one of the most vulnerable populations that's been hit by COVID-19, as along with everyone. As for the next question, how does resettlement affect the child's mental state, and what are some ways teachers, daycare providers, or other people who work with children outside of their homes can help?
Culture shift or cultural adjustment is the first issue that the child may experience after resettlement in the United States. This culture shift brings a lot of immediate change, which the child left unguided may have hard time to cope, or they may not be able to cope. They are prone to be bullied, physically or emotionally hurt, or easily misunderstood, not just by fellow students, but also teachers as well. Not many teachers are trained or have knowledge about refugees and how culture impacts child's behavior. Factors such as language, either language differences, they do speak English, but then the diction, the pronunciation are different, and so other kids in school laugh at them. If they are limited English proficient, all the more that they have problem, because they just cannot communicate. And if they speak their own language, all the more people will laugh at them because nobody understood. It's not really good not to know the language, especially English, when you go to school in an American educational system. But what can you do? You're a refugee. You're just newly resettled. Race, even among Americans, race is an issue. Refugees are not exempted from this perspective, either consciously or unconsciously, by their fellow kids or by the teachers or any adult for that matter. The community may not be able to see them without bias, because race is an issue. And we're still working towards bridging that divide. Refugees just have extra effort for them to be integrated into the community and to be welcome and accepted. Others could be culture-based behavior. the school where refugees went to may not be the same school that they attended. Example, if a child was schooled in a refugee camp under the tree, as in literally under the tree, they might feel claustrophobic getting into the four walls of the classroom, right? Instead of looking at the sun and the sky, they are looking at walls. And so that is a lot of adjustment for them. They may not, they may feel claustrophobic. Another would be, in terms of tone and diction and methodology, where they come from, they may only have one teacher from morning till afternoon. And here in the new American system, they have five teachers and they rotate every day because each subject has its own teacher. So they adapt and adjust to the tone, inflection, methodology of each of these teachers. And they, five teachers might be too much, you know. Instead of one, they are now shifted to five teachers, five different adults to adjust, adapt, and understand. That's a lot in the point of view of a child. Some in the schools, some refugee children would be labeled as non-compliant, non-cooperative, non-conforming, showing disruptive behavior, when actually the child never meant it that way. The child, a refugee who is used to physical activity where they came from, let's say a farming community, they will feel restless sitting in, you know, inside the classroom in just a chair and a table with pencil and paper, because that's not the world where they grew up with. The disruptive issue, that might not be what they meant, but rather that's how adults or teachers perceive them. And so they are reported to the principal and to the counselor and given disciplinary actions for disruptive behavior, when actually, according to them, it feels normal. That's just the way they behave in their classroom. I mean, there are no walls. Hey, what prevents you from going left to right? There's no wall. The whole playground is your classroom. And your classroom is a playground as well. So it makes a difference. Refugee children are easily misunderstood and misjudged, and they must suffer the consequence all their lives. The child refugee can be easily bullied, and they either run, they fight, or freeze. If they choose to run, where do they run? Where will they go to? If they choose to fight, how much trouble will it be? If they choose to freeze, how dangerous will the situation be? So anybody in school can help. Do they know that? Does a refugee child know that? How will they communicate, especially if they don't speak English? How much trust does a refugee child give to an adult in the education system? So those are very legitimate questions, and the child has to navigate and deal with all this as they come to the classroom. Post-COVID-19, the child refugee need to learn through virtual classroom. Do they have the equipment? Do they have a computer? And if they have a computer, do they have the internet? We know that the cell phone, which is usually what they have, is not enough. You cannot access your lessons through the cell phone, and probably they will hurt their eyes after an hour or two just looking at the lesson through that little window in the cell phone. Mm-hmm. Some may not have the smartphone, actually. Some may have the flip phone, so all the more they cannot access. And if they do have equipment, they do have the internet, how well can they navigate the program? Does the computer have the program which can operate the lessons provided by the schools? They may not have. Can they afford to buy school supplies and materials to carry out, such as, for example, a science equipment. So the teacher is there. They are asked to bring this material or have this material ready so they can see what happens. Do they have the funds to purchase the material? And do they have access to that material? Can they go to the dollar store? Can they go to the convenience store? So those are legitimate questions. And most of all, how do they overcome language barriers? Or is there someone who can help them with homework? So our refugee resettlement agencies are trying to do something to deal with all this, but we cannot provide individual services. I mean, one case manager, one school liaison, one health liaison, that's not enough to service 80 families, probably 50 children. That's not just possible. So we need to communicate and get support from the community, and how good a relationship with the community and the stakeholders will generally contribute to how easy and efficient and effective we can be in dealing with this, because, you know, it takes the whole community to raise a child.
Yeah, definitely how important it is for everyone to contribute, along with teachers just recognizing and how many to also step up. As for the next question, pretty much already answered about what makes youth refugees so unique. So let's move on to the next question. Why do you believe that mental health is such an important issue to address within the refugee community?
Okay. Yeah, mental health is such an important issue to address with the refugee community. That's basically why I was employed to work. The Virginia Refugee Healing Partnership is focused on refugee mental health, because we know unless somebody looks after the refugee mental health, the system does not generally carry kind of conversation about refugee and refugee mental health. It's just not available. It's a minority population, the minority of the minority of the minority. Usually it's a conversation between the Spanish-speaking people or the Black people. Other parts of the community or the society, the minorities such as the LGBTQ, they're not part of the conversation. Refugees, they're not part of the conversation. Intellectual disability could be part because there's a law like the ADA or American with Disabilities Act, but generally refugees are not even part of the conversation. I'm really sorry and blunt to say that, but that is the truth. So my work, I'm not just being biased, this is my work, so it is important. With refugees, we operate on a triple trauma paradigm. It is often believed that refugees and immigrants are in the midst of chronological interaction of three distinct phases of traumatic periods. A trauma of their country of origin, such as war, persecution, you know, the trauma during the escape or the journey of immigration. Example, some could be in the refugee camp for 20 years or more. Others, there is no refugee camps, so they just kind of merge along with the other communities. But of course, employment is not available. If there is no specific program, their legitimacy to get work is not recognized, and so they are not given jobs. They are considered to be taking jobs from those who are residents of that community or that country. So those are a lot of issues and causes trauma, because if you don't have money in a different country, that impacts your ability to meet the basic necessities of life. And when you have a family with you, that complicates the matter. Triple the mental health risk and mental health issues. You know, you can suffer only for yourself with no problem, but you cannot close your eyes and see your loved ones suffering. So that's a lot there to deal with during the trauma of the escape and journey to immigration. And then the third phase is trauma on the relocation process. How I describe it is that refugees evaded or avoided issues or dangers of the jungle, of trees and of animals. And they come to the United States only to meet another kind of jungle, jungle of buildings, jungle of cars. You know, yeah, there are no animals, but cars are all over. So we have refugees who died hit by the car. I mean, she survived resettlement in another country, and she grew up nice and healthy. And when they came to America, she was hit by a car because it's a jungle of cars. Some people who are relocated in a city may find buildings as sometimes enticing, but sometimes it's scary because even our supermarket here is bigger than their town hall. So it might be their first time to come into such a huge building with so many things that they don't even recognize, because that's not the food they eat. It's not available where they came from. I don't say that in general this is what's happening. I'm just saying that there could be refugees who have high education and came from a wealthy society, but there are refugees who came from the other end of the spectrum, and that they have not even, the first time they ride the bus is when they were taken from the refugee camp to the airport because they are to relocate. Some are super, super high end of the spectrum, and that before they were resettled to the United States, they have really good life. The basic needs and the basic accommodations that we provide is not even comparable to the helpers at home. We call them domestic helpers. Theirs are talking about 62-inch super upgraded TV, and we don't provide them. The bed we gave is just flat. Theirs is way complicated, probably 4-poster. But because of safety, they have to leave and they resettle to the United States. And when they come here, those are adjustment problems. You know, when you are on top and you are pulled to the middle, that's an adjustment problem. When you come from below and you are pulled to the middle, that's also an adjustment problem. So dealing with refugees is not a one-way approach. It's done almost by culture, by individual, by the group, by the population we serve, and all this is being navigated by our refugee resettlement staff. You can work with them and ask them that each individual refugee are dealt with almost on an individual basis in terms of how we address needs. We don't provide general cookie cutter services. Yeah. For the Refugee Healing Partnership, we have several community-based intervention programs that caters to support the youth, helping another youth. There is one that is provided after school. There is one provided as a summer program. There are ongoing classes in the school through their ESL, to the school ESL program. We do connect with community partners, so we can support refugee direct service helpers as well as the refugees themselves through community-based interventions, so that the impact is wider and more sustainable, because if we bring it to the community, the community may continue doing what we have started if the time comes that we are not able to sustain the program anymore.
Yeah, it's definitely really hard challenges. Just for the last question, just what are some mental health resources, overall resources available to refugees in Virginia?
We have different resources. So, example, I mentioned training. Knowledge is important because you cannot do what you intentionally do unless you know it. So we have statewide trainings for cultural competency. That's important piece. The other is we also have training in suicide prevention using both mental health first aid and the QPR gatekeepers suicide program. The other is trauma and trauma-informed care. Last year, we have all medical liaisons, school liaisons to come and be trained how to facilitate training for refugees and the community. Right now, we are reformatting our in-person training into an online training to provide trauma and trauma-informed care training to refugee resettlement staff, also refugee leaders, as well as refugees themselves. So we have kind of a triple approach because we believe that each of them need to have some training so that in the end they can be talking in one piece. The other is, you know, we have training for Refugee Health Screener 15. If someone, any resettlement staff who wants to learn how the Refugee Health Screening 15 is being administered, we offer that either in a group, one person, two person, a group of 10, a group of 15. As long as people want to learn, I offer it. I'm a trained facilitator for this Refugee Health Screener 15. And also, I have a background in counseling. Although I'm not a clinical practitioner, my master's degree is in counseling. So this goes well with testing. And I love doing it. The other is about class standards or culturally and linguistically appropriate services. We gave training for that as well. We have behavioral health interpreting, which could cascade to employment opportunities for qualified interpreters, those who speak good English and proficient in English and also in their language of service. Also, we provide language access orientation for providers so that it's not just enough that case managers do the explanation. Sometimes our agency, on a statewide level, we need to provide information to our clinicians so that they understand each other when it comes to refugees seeking mental health treatment and care. So other than statewide training, we also provide four conferences, annual conferences, and these are refugee-focused conferences, identifying needs and addressing the needs of refugees. And it's held in Roanoke, Northern Virginia, Hampton Roads, and in Richmond. So if we cannot bring everyone to Richmond, we bring the training to other parts of the state. So everyone will have the benefit of getting updated information, networking with others. And if they do have something to contribute, we put it as a workshop because we do believe that best practice and those that have proven to have worked in a certain environment, such as our refugees and the area where refugees are resettled, are very, very important rather than providing a training that has not been applied in Virginia and to refugee populations. So other than training and conferences, we do have materials as well as part of our resource. These are developed refugee-focused materials. Some of it are done by the state. Others are done in collaboration with our refugee mental health coalitions. Example would be the Mental Health English as a Second Language. This was developed by the state through the Refugee Healing Partnership Program. We believe that, sorry about that. We are close to Langley, so.
Okay.
Okay, the Mental Health English as a Second Language is a one-hour course that is flexible to be broken down into two sessions. What it does is teach refugees how to convey basic terminologies that clinicians have identified that could help them communicate with refugees and understand refugee issues. The other is a storybook of refugee experiences as seen from the eyes of a child. The Roanoke Refugee Mental Health Council has developed this storybook and we disseminated it statewide. It's about, you know, refugee stories. Then we also have a guidebook on navigating the behavioral health system. It's for everybody, including volunteers, and it's available electronically and in printed format. We have community mental health awareness training, which is a 2 to 4 hour training about mental health. It's not about mental health illness. It's about dealing with mental health issues, identifying issues, but it's from within the person. It's not about case managers identifying who has mental health issues or not. As mentioned, we are not clinically trained to do that. So all we can do really is to reflect on ourselves. And this community mental health awareness training is developed with refugee leaders from Fredericksburg and Richmond. We also have COVID infographics developed by Northern Virginia Coalition for Refugee Wellness that's available in print as well as electronically. We have podcasts other than this, the Hampton Roads Refugee Resettlement and the VCCI Hampton Roads have also developed a podcast that features refugee experience during COVID-19. So there are many other things. There are resources which are available statewide and the whole refugee program initiated by the federal level, at the federal level. But all I can say is that these resources have no impact unless being used. For mental health services, we have this local mental health coalition that has developed their own mental health referral system. How effective that be, it depends on how active the coalition is, because we, from our experience, we need to update it at least every 6 months. The provider that we use to refer refugees may not be available by now. What used to be services that are free in this facility may no longer be available. The private provider that provide pro bono services may not be there anymore. So it got to be updated, but it really depends on how active the mental health coalition is. There are 40 community services board across Virginia, and CSB, as a shortcut for community services board, is our gateway to public mental health care. But the irony is that they do not offer the same services across the board. So let's say the community services board in Hampton Roads may offer these kinds of services, but compared to Roanoke may only offer these services. Some services in Richmond may not be available in Charlottesville. So we do have public access to mental health care and treatment, and we do have a program called Step Virginia, which includes a same-day service for assessment of mental health, of clients suspected of mental health issues. So there are avenues, but we need the resettlement direct service providers to be aware and be involved so they can use this effectively and efficiently. Overall, the Virginia Refugee Healing Partnership and the local mental health council highly rely on community-based interventions and support because on our own, there's not much we can do. I myself, as a state coordinator, can do just so little, but with the support of the local mental health council, the refugee resettlement, and our Office of Newcomer Services, we can do a lot as a in partnership or in collaboration with each other. So mental health is very important. It impacts the lives of people. Sometimes we know it early and it can be, treatment could be easier and integrated into everyday lives, but it could be identified under late stages, which really needs special support such as confinement, residential treatment. And we hope that as we move along and share information about refugee mental health, we will be able to tap clinicians, both public and private, law enforcement, both state and local, as well as the schools that, you know, refugees is a special population. They just need time to adjust. They need help and guidance so that they can be integrated in our community. Refugees do help in terms our economy. Refugees do help with diversity. Our refugees do contribute to society. So a little help for them to start as they begin their lives in the United States is matters a lot. It does matters.
Yeah, thank you for offering those are all the questions I have for you, Eva. Thank you for joining us and sharing your experience about the refugee population.
Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be part of your program and your project.
To find out more information, be sure to follow us on our social media on Facebook at ECDCACC, on Instagram, ECDCACC Metro, on YouTube, ECDCACCDC, on our website at ECCDC.org, or if you're interested in volunteering, please email us at volunteer@ECDCUS.org. And that's all. Thank you for joining us in our episode, and we hope to join you. We hope you join us again next month on Resettle the Human Journey.
Thank you, Carl.